So far, I think we've been talking about how women engaged with what you might call extra parliamentary politics, which is pressure groups, political organisations like the Chartists, and also local government. However, they are also involved directly with Parliament. And we can see this in a number of ways as we look at the period in the immediate run-up to the formal organised suffrage movement. Perhaps the main way in which they engage with the institution of Parliament is via petitioning. Now, there are very famous key petitions. One of them's the 1832 petition, which a woman called Mary Smith of Stanmore in Yorkshire gets Henry Hunt, who's a very important sort of radical politician at this period, to present to Parliament. And in that petition in 1832, which is the year where a Reform Act is introduced enfranchising a limited number of more middle-class male voters, but more importantly, for the first time, it says that the vote should be vested in a male person for the first time. So in her petition, Mary Smith argues that, in fact, all women who pay taxes should also have the vote, on the basis that there are substantial female taxpayers who should not be disenfranchised. And this is something that's taken up by the later suffrage movement, who argue that the 1832 Reform Act was actually a step backwards, that women had always, in theory, possessed the vote if they were property owners, and it was Parliament that stopped them exercising that vote in 1832. Now, whether that's actually accurate or not is perhaps more contested. It's very difficult to see examples of women actually exercising the parliamentary vote before 1832. But in theory, there was nothing in the law that said they could not. There was nothing that specified which sex a voter needed to be. As we go forward, then petitioning becomes a really important strategy for female campaigners. You might expect petitioning to fall out of favour as Parliament gets more formal and more organised and more bureaucratic and you have civil servants, but in fact the population seem to fall back and use much more extensively this older form of what you might call a conversation with Parliament or a lobbying of Parliament. So the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s and so on see a number of very, very large petitions, some of which were organised by women. These obviously cover things like Chartism, but there are also petitions on things like whether there should be trading on the Sabbath, whether there should be copyright reform, anti-slavery is another one, factory acts. There are a number of female petitions against the reform of working hours for women in factories or against the elimination of women and children from the mines, for example, because they see this as a direct attack on their livelihood. And in some of these small mining villages, the mining is the only employment for women and children. So whilst there is some sort of sympathy with the humanitarian element, there's also a certain amount of resistance which sees this legislation as taking their livelihoods away from them. There are campaigns against the introduction of the Poor Law and for the reform of the Poor Law. As you go forward into the 1860s, there's an 1870s, there's a massive campaign against something called the Contagious Diseases Act, which is where Parliament starts to introduce a system of regulation of prostitution. But the regulation is only directed at the prostitutes themselves and not directed at the men who use those prostitutes. And again, women particularly see this as an unjust act by a male parliament and argue that if they had the vote, this sort of legislation would not be passed because it targets women unfairly and unnecessarily. And it isn't really dealing with the issue of prostitution or of Contagious Diseases Act in particular. They're thinking of a disease called syphilis. And then there are also obviously petitions for women to have the vote. The first of those is the 1866 petition, where in another Reform Act has been introduced into Parliament to give all working men who are heads of households the vote. And again, the women try and tack on an amendment which will give female heads of households the vote. But like many of the petitions that go before Parliament, they're very easily sidestepped. Now, there are other ways in which women can engage with Parliament in this period, which may not be that obvious again, but were very important. So most of the areas of reform in legislation, whether it's in healthcare, in education, in crime, or prisons, even in areas such as the creation of museums and art galleries and so on, Parliament usually had a select committee or a royal commission to look into the question before they came up with the blueprints for the legislation. Now, in all of these papers of commissions, whether it's into employment law or into emigration policy or prison reform, you will find on those pages women acting as expert witnesses, mostly because of their authority and their experience at local levels in administering some of these key activities or key areas of government. So there are famous women like Elizabeth Fry, for example, speaks in 1819, as early as 1819, to a commission on prison reform. Caroline Chisholm, who is on the Australian dollar notes, she was a campaigner for female emigration to Australia, but also once these women got over to Australia, she was interested in their employment and their welfare and how they were looked after. So she very powerfully gave evidence to select committees looking at things like transportation, but also emigration schemes. But there are lots more lowly women, so women factory workers, women flower girls making artificial flowers, for example, in sweatshops in London, also give evidence. So you hear through the pages of these parliamentary reports the voices of very ordinary women, but also the impact that they're having on changing policy.